Well, that's the Afghan national anthem. Introduced here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Harrod, where we like to analyze important current events for conservatives and others. And Afghan national anthem sings in its English lyrics. You can look at online that so long as a single Afghan breathes, there will be this Afghanistan. Long live the Afghan nation and long live the Afghan Republic. The Taliban's taken over. That was the old national anthem. We'll see if the Taliban wants to have a new national anthem. But we've got a lot of refugees now coming to America from Afghanistan. And to discuss these issues, we want to turn to Center for Immigration Studies Executive Director Mark Krikorian, a fellow Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy graduate with me, to discuss what should America expect from these Afghan refugees coming to America. Well, Mark, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, we look at this sort of disastrous, chaotic withdrawal from the United States and its coalition allies from Afghanistan in the summer of 2021, right before the 20th anniversary of 9/11. How many refugees then have come to the United States are en route due to this withdrawal?
Well, we've brought in something like 76,000 refugees into the U.S. We flew out more than that, but they're not all here. A couple thousand more are at U.S. military bases, and then there's thousands more that we parked in other countries, third countries. They may or may not stay there, and then there's going to be an ongoing flow. Remember, because this, you know, people are still trying to get out of Afghanistan, getting to Pakistan, trying to get out. So that ongoing flow will continue. But so far, what we've taken up to now, as far as what they're telling us, is about 76,000 people, all of whom were at least temporarily housed at military bases until they could be hooked up with refugee resettlement groups or what have you. And so now almost all of them have left those bases and are just, you know, wherever they're going to live. Afghans are especially concentrated in Sacramento, in Northern Virginia, and I think in Dallas, in Texas. That's like where the biggest concentrations are.
Well, how many more then might come? You talk about a continuing flow of, you know, we've seen in news reports of Afghans trying to get into Iran or Pakistan, other neighbors of Afghanistan. How many more might come in coming years?
Who knows? I mean, it could be as many as that. It could be double, triple, quadruple. I mean, it depends on a lot of things, including who the president is, because the president sets the annual refugee resettlement ceiling. This is not for people who just, you know, are rushing onto planes, but the normal process of refugee resettlement where people are abroad and we decide for whatever reason that we're going to bring them in as refugees, the president can set whatever number he wants, frankly. And if he's got, you know, if there's the infrastructure to resettle those, all of these contractors paid by the State Department, he could take in, you know, 76,000 more Afghans next year, conceivably. I mean, we literally have no idea, but it's going to be a lot, whatever it is.
Oh, that's interesting. So you say the setting of any annual refugee cap is really just left to the discretion of the executive, the president.
Yeah, yes. Now, the way the law says is the president sets it in consultation with Congress. What that really means is he just sends them a letter and says, yeah, this is how many I'm going to take in. You know what I mean? In other words, there's no real consultation. There's no mechanism for Congress to, you know, veto it or anything like that. This is all part of the 1980 Refugee Act, which was set up by Congress after the Vietnam fiasco and all the refugees that came in, because basically the executive branch after Vietnam just let in whoever it felt like letting in. I mean, they just ignored immigration law altogether. And Congress was trying to regain control, and frankly, they didn't do a good enough job, and you know, they were going to have to revisit that and try to regain some control over how many refugees the president lets into the country every year.
Oh, I see. Was there any law regulating refugees coming before that? Or is it purely presidential discretion, the executive branch simply say, we designate these people as refugees and they can come in?
There technically was a there was sort of rules for who refugees are, and there were even numbers limiting them. This is before the 1980 Act. But what happened was, and this dates back really to the 50s, presidents used something called parole. This is not the parole for criminals, an immigration parole. Congress granted in the early 50s a very narrow authority to presidents so that they could let in people who didn't have any other right to come in if there was some kind of emergency reason. The Congress envisioned this as the kind of thing you do for, like, if somebody's, you know, doesn't have time to get a visa and needs a organ transplant or something. In other words, real emergency situations that can't wait for visas. Well, as soon as they passed that, presidents, Democrat and Republican, have said, oh, okay, great, I can just let in anybody I want. And so that's how, before the Refugee Act, most refugees were just let in by presidents saying, yeah, I consider it in the national interest, and we're just going to let in however hundreds of thousands of people just, you know, on my say-so, period. We actually have a new paper out tracing the history and maybe some offering some solutions about how Congress might fix that. But the 1980 Refugee Act was an attempt to rein in executive freelancing on refugees, on immigration really, but using specifically on the refugee part of it. And, you know, it hasn't really done that. It hasn't succeeded. The problem is still there. So that's why I say, depending on who the president is, they can let in however many Afghans they feel like.
Well, I guess you can think of previous refugee waves. You know, we think of foreign policy. I guess right in the 1950s, of course, you know, you had the Cold War, in particular in 1956, you know, you had waves of refugees coming out
right.
of Hungary to various countries. You know, you have emergencies like that. And, of course, before the 1950s, maybe there was also then you can talk about this, any sort of memory, of bad memory of, you know, what happened to all the Jews who were so desperate to get out of World War II, but the United States and all the other countries around the world, you know, particularly at the Evian Conference in France in 1938, they said, you know, we're just not going to take in these people. We, you know, we don't want this. So was there any sort of thinking there that we just needed a broad discretion to bring in people?
Yeah, I mean, really our whole refugee and asylum system, because they're kind of two sides of the same coin, is a holdover. It's kind of like a hangover from World War II. And the rules, the international rules, which we put into U.S. law in that 1980 Act that I talked about, were basically put together in right after World War II in a U.N. treaty, early 1950s. We signed on to the basically the corollary of it in 1967. And it was designed for an entirely different world. It was designed for a world where, you know, you've got Russian ballerinas defecting one at a time, that sort of thing. Whereas now, with easy and cheap transportation and communications, with massive population growth in the very countries that, you know, would people would want to leave from, our whole asylum and refugee system is an anachronism and needs to be revisited from the bottom up. It needs the old 70-year-old rules need to be scrapped, quite frankly, and we need to start all over again, because what this whole process of refugee and asylum granting, as we saw, say, in Europe in 2015, and as we're seeing now on the southern border, is really little more than a way for not just illegal immigrants, but for post-national groups, you know, Soros types, but I mean, he's just one person in that kind of movement, to use refugee and asylum rules as a kind of crowbar to pry open the borders of developed countries and basically negate their ability, the ability of the people who live in those countries through their democratic representatives to actually control who comes into their country. So asylum and refugee policy has become basically a way to dissolve borders, and it can't be that, and it's got to change. Mm-hmm.
Well, you talk about the southern border. That brings in another fascinating. You talk about, you know, Afghans trying to get to the United States. Has there been any developing concern or any evidence indicating that Afghans might somehow make their way into Latin America, Mexico, and make their way across the southern border?
They are, in fact, doing that. I just talked with one of my analysts who's an intelligence, former intelligence analyst, lives in Texas, and he said he knows all kinds of people in Border Patrol, et cetera, and they said, yeah, there's Afghans coming over, and nobody's vetting them. And, you know, the numbers aren't huge, but it only took 19 people to do 9/11. And the fact is that what we're seeing at the southern border isn't just the old story of Mexicans, you know, young Mexican men coming to work on farms. That's like a 70-year-old stereotype. It no longer applies. It's not even just the people from the three northern countries of Central America, which came to dominate the flow. There's more of them than there are Mexicans coming over. But now, an enormous share, in January, like more than 40% of the illegal immigrants apprehended at the Mexican border were neither from Mexico nor from those three Central American countries. Now, some of them were from Ecuador and Cuba and Haiti, but, you know, they were from all over the place. This analyst I was talking about, our national security analyst, he went down to Mexico, southern Mexico. He's been down to Costa Rica, where a lot of the smuggling has to go through, and to Panama. He's talked to all kinds of people from Eritrea, from Mauritania. There's people from the former Soviet Union, and there's Afghans. There's everything coming over, because if the border's open and the word gets out, well, then, you know, it's worth taking a chance. And if you, you know, you fail once, they throw you back. You keep trying until you make it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. Thinking of, say, some person from Afghanistan, what might be a possible way of them getting to the southern border? I mean, would they, like, maybe put together some money and buy an airplane ticket to fly into, like, Mexico or something, and then make their way?
Yeah, it's not that people don't do that on their own, generally speaking. This analyst, again, I'll mention him, Todd Benzman. I'll plug his book. I forget the name of it right now, but he just wrote
Losing Control. No, that's the other book.
Yes, Losing Control. Thank you. No. That's an earlier
Border
book
War,
that was on. Yes,
Border War.
Yeah,
right?
It's
yeah, Todd Benzman.
Yeah, so
I've had on the show before, and yeah, I always enjoy talking with him.
And that's what he wrote his master's thesis called, America's Covert Border War. He wrote his master's thesis at the Naval Postgraduate School on what he called marathon smugglers. In other words, people from Asia and Africa, the Middle East, and how those networks work. And they're all, it's not somebody who, you know, sort of stumbles across the border into Pakistan and then, you know, goes on orbits and buys a ticket. Doesn't work like that. It's an organized network, and people will either, you know, hawk their farm or whatever it is to pay for the smugglers, or go into debt, kind of be indentured servants, sort of. And they'll be flown, say, to Moscow, and then to Havana, and then maybe to Ecuador, which has very loose rules, no visas for most people. And then from there, they would, like, take a bus or walk or whatever it is the rest of the way, which is a long, long way. But that's what happens. You got people going, you know, from Ecuador. They go through Colombia. They go through Panama, where there's this really brutal jungle you have to pass through with no roads. And then they just make their way up through Central America, through Mexico, and get to the border. So this is a very common thing. And if people have some money, depending on what country they come from and, you know, whether Mexico allows them to come in without visas, you're seeing a lot of people just flying straight to cities near the border in Mexico and then hopping a bus or whatever and coming across. So you're seeing a lot of that in Yuma, Arizona now, where people from all over the world are coming across because there's gaps in the fence, and that's become one of the hot spots on the border. And I just read today, I hadn't looked at the numbers, but in January, Del Rio, Texas, the place where all of those Haitians were under the bridge, remember that last fall, which is a very remote area. There's nothing else there along that part of the Texas border. That's now the busiest part of the border, or it was in January. And that's, again, not guys, farmhands from Mexico. That's people from, you name it, abroad, who are, you know, who are being smuggled, and the smugglers move people around, and they figure, okay, this is the best place now to be able to get people across.
Well, that's just, you say some of them might engage in a kind of indentured servitude to pay their way. How does that work, and what do they do?
Well, I mean, that could happen. It could work any number of ways, but you basically, you know, you say, look, I will, you know, if you smuggle me, your, like, organization smuggles me into the U.S., I'll work in, you know, washing dishes in your Chinese restaurant to pay off my passage. And that, you know, if I leave before that, you know, you'll go and kill my sister back home. And, you know, when I work off my passage, then I can go and get any other job. That kind of thing happens all the time. It's actually relatively frequent. I couldn't give you percentages of people, but that is not an uncommon thing where people just don't have the money, but smugglers say, look, we'll take you for free, and then you'll work for us for however many number of years until you work off your passage, which is literally what indentured servitude was in the old days.
Right. So that then requires like a certain cooperation from the businesses here in the United States, like a Chinese restaurant or whatever would have to, you know, engage in some network saying, hey, we want some workers and, you know, like maybe we'll send you a portion of the pay or something.
These smuggling networks are very sophisticated, integrated organizations. So absolutely. Now, you know, either they're all part of the same organization or they're just cooperating. They're like business allies. So you see that at the border itself, where the drug cartels, the Mexican drug cartels, they don't do the smuggling itself. They're not in the smuggling business. What they do, though, is because the different cartels control every inch of the Mexican side of the border, they charge a tax to the actual smuggling rings to let people go across. So part of your smuggling fee that you pay to the guy who's smuggling you goes to the drug cartels as free money to them, basically. It's just a tax for passage. And so that they're working together, but they're separate organizations. The other thing drug cartels do at the border is they will instruct the smugglers to, you know, take your, say, 200 women and children and cross them at this place on the border at this time so as to totally tie up the Border Patrol and overwhelm their ability to patrol the rest of the border. And then guess what? Other parts of the border are open and unpatrolled. Then the cartel does its main business, which is bringing dope across, so that they actually use the migrant flow, which is, you know, essentially invited by Biden's policies and rhetoric. They use that flow as a way to help them get more drugs across the border. It's not so much the immigrants themselves bring in the dope. It's that they're used as part of a tactic to distract attention and overwhelm the Border Patrol so that other places are wide open and you can bring in anything you want.
Interesting. The statistics you're reporting at CIS has cited, and you indicate, so some 76,000 Afghan refugees have come in, according to government statistics, with more to come. And from your readings at CIS, something like 123,000 people were flown out of Afghanistan, of
right.
whom some 6,000 were citizens, American citizens, or green card holders. I guess were some of them maybe Afghans who had obtained that before, or just regular native-born American citizens. How many Afghan refugees have we had previously in the United States, and what has our experience been with them in the United States?
Well, it's a good question. I don't have those numbers at hand, but we did obviously start taking Afghans shortly after the Soviet invasion in late 79, early 1980. I guess it was early 1980. But those original – those earlier Afghan refugees we took were mainly elite folks. These were, you know, citified educated, literate people, lived in cities, elite people who fled, doctors and what have you. And the kind of more working class peasant folks ended up in staying in Pakistan and Iran. What we saw with this evacuation was anybody who could muscle their way onto those planes got into the United States, including people who, I mean, there was this one example of a guy who was molesting, like, I think she was a three-year-old girl in Quantico Marine Base. I think it was Quantico. He was at, this is when they were still being held for processing at bases in the U.S. There were Marines around. This guy was molesting this girl, and they were like, you know, what's going on? Oh, well, it's just part of my culture. So what we're getting a different class of Afghan refugee now. Some of them still were relatively educated, modern people who, you know, as difficult as it might be to make the transition, at least are familiar with the mores of a regular modern society. But we're getting lots of people who are, you know, literally living in the Middle Ages. In fact, the Middle Ages might be a little more advanced than these people's experience. And, you know, their adjustment, both for them and their effect on a broader society, is going to be a lot harder. You're going to have lots of people who don't think that they're doing anything wrong by taking two wives or molesting little boys or whatever it is, because it's like, well, you know, what do you mean? This is just normal where I come from. And again, I'm not even saying this in a way to sort of make fun of them. It's that these people are an unbelievable mismatch with a modern society, and it would have been better both for them and for us and for a third country if they were resettled somewhere else that was more kind of in tune, was less different from the place that they're coming from.
Well, that raises an interesting point. I mean, you discussed earlier the 1980 law regulating refugees in the United States. You know, that was in the wake of the pullout from Vietnam, the collapse of the South Vietnamese Republic, and waves of people coming from Southeast Asia into the United States and other countries. You know, dealing with, looking at other refugee waves like Vietnamese, you know, the Hungarians we talked about before, have we ever experienced such sort of cultural problems of people coming in and they, you know, they think something is normal like polygamy or, you know, having sex with, you know, underage individuals, girls or boys. But, you know, we have to tell them, hey, look, you're not supposed to do that.
The, you know, anytime, obviously, any foreigner comes to another country, they're going to be, you know, it's going to be an experience, a problem for them until they adjust. But like I said, people coming from more advanced backgrounds have fewer problems. The two examples of a kind of significant-sized refugee flow from, you know, really backward societies, and I don't use backward in a normative sense. I mean, they really are dramatically less developed than anything that we have experience with. The two examples of that really stand out are, one are the Hmong from Laos that came because they were fighting. These were hill tribes, hill people. You know, they lived on dirt floors, the whole thing. And they were fighting on our side because they were, you know, they were against the communists. And once the communists won, the North Vietnamese basically, you know, were trying to wipe them out. So we ended up bringing a significant number of them to, they ended up concentrating in Fresno, Minneapolis, and Providence, Rhode Island. And they really did have, and to some degree still have a real problem in adjusting and somehow, you know, making a life here. I mean, it's, but they've actually, that's actually worked out better than the other big example of people who really are a profound mismatch with a modern society, and that's Somalis, who are the biggest concentrations of them are, again, in Minneapolis and in Columbus, Ohio. I mean, they're not just there, but those are the two big places. And you see real real problems. I mean, deep alienation, and even the ones who succeed, like Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, whose father was part of the dictator's government that fell. It was the last government that actually controlled Somalia. And so, you know, they weren't poor, but, you know, even she's dramatically alienated from America. And then you get, you know, when you get people who are, you know, they come from a tribal background, very, very, very less developed, both socially, economically, culturally, everything. It's really hard for people like that to make it, especially when you're in large numbers. If you got two families in a city, you know, there may be some tragedies. They may not. They may make it. You might be okay. When you're bringing in thousands of them, it's a problem both for them and for the broader society.
Well, yeah, I wanted to ask you about those two particular examples. You know, I grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota area, in a suburb there, Edina. So both the Hmong in the 1980s, as then well later in the 1990s, the Somalis have, you know, had some sort of have had a personal sort of relationship to me and to the Twin Cities, the Minnesota area there. In particular, when I was in high school, we had some older Hmong individuals. They were like in their early 20s or something, but they were going to high school to, you know, get a high school degree, learn English and so forth. I was involved with some tutoring of a Hmong individual in high school in the English class, you know, and they went to, you know, ultimately they went to high school graduation with us and so forth. I remember some of them riding around on like their mopeds and everything. But, you know, yeah, those are two, you know, the two prominent examples there in Minneapolis, the first the Hmong and then the Somalis. But you say that the Hmong had some problems, but they sort of ultimately adapted. But the Somalis, I guess, you know, particularly the Somalis have raised issues of like terrorism recruitment for the Islamic State and then for Al-Shabaab in Somalia.
Yeah, I mean, the, you know, the Hmong still, when you look at like the, you know, median income of different immigrant groups, the Hmong are still way down on that list. So, but, you know, then both the numbers were smaller and they do seem to have, especially the young people, adjusted and, you know, are making their way in this country. The problem, you know, frankly, the problem with the Somalis is that there are they are so different from the rest of society. I would, my sense is even more different than the Hmong were, that, you know, it's very difficult for them to adjust to the realities of a modern society. The young people, they're not Somali really anymore, if they were born and brought up here, but they don't really see themselves as American. Now, that often happens, immigrant groups, that kind of thing happens. This, in other words, this isn't a difference in kind, but it really is a difference, it seems to me, in degree. This is, I'm not optimistic that the, you know, how the experience of Somalis in this country is going to go in the future. And that really just underlines the, what I would argue is the immorality of large-scale refugee resettlement, because, and even just looking at it from a cost perspective, it's dramatically more expensive to resettle a refugee in the United States than it is to take care of them near their home. So in the case of Somalis, you know, taking care of somebody in Kenya who's from a Somali refugee is hugely less expensive, which means you can help more people. We looked at the cost of resettling refugees from the Middle East and the cost of taking care of them, according to the UN, in the countries like Syrians and Turkey, for instance. And it's 12 times more expensive to bring somebody here. So there may be specific emergency cases where people literally cannot stay for one more hour where they are. The UN actually has a list of those people, and there's not that many of them in any given year. Bringing people from, let's say in this case, Somali refugees from Kenya to the United States, obviously is good for the ones who get here in the sense that, you know, their quality of life sure goes up. But what about the other 11 people that we're not helping with the money that we're spending on the ones we bring here? It's the analogy I use is that imagine there's 12 people floundering in the water. Do you throw 12 life preservers to them, which aren't great, but it'll keep you alive? Or do you send a yacht that can carry one person and leave the other 11 on their own? It's just, I mean, it's immoral. Large-scale refugee resettlement is morally bankrupt. It is a purely virtue-signaling enterprise. It's for people to make themselves feel better and to show other people how good they are by helping, you know, one family, because no one else is going to see the other 11 families who are screwed because we're not spending the money on them. And when people say, well, you know, we can do both. No, we can't, because money is not infinite. I mean, as it is, we're living off of borrowed money from the Chinese. Whatever we're going to spend on refugee protection should be devoted to doing the most good for the most number of people. And, you know, instead of bringing one refugee to resettle in the United States, how about we double what we spend on the, you know, the 12 refugees? And I mean, how about instead of bringing one person, let's say it costs $1,200, let's just say, to bring a refugee to taxpayers' cost to have a refugee come to the United States. Well, how about we let those 12 people stay there, spend the $1,200 on the people who are already there? Let's say we double it and spend $200 per refugee and improve the water and in the place that they're staying and improve maybe better education for the kids. All of those options are more morally defensible than this show-offy virtue signaling process of bringing refugees and resettling them in the United States.
Yeah, it's interesting. In your own state that CIS and your other experts have discussed this, that before this recent influx, there was something like 133,000 Afghans in the United States going back to 1980, but that encompassed a particular surge precisely after 2000, you know, after 9/11. I think the numbers had gone from like 50,000 to like then 133,000. And as you indicated, and your statistics indicate, you know, most of those Afghans have remained disproportionately poor, although there's some, as you say, that you know, come from these sort of elite backgrounds are actually, you know, wealthy in the United States, but that's more an exemplary case. You know, I guess one thing that I would compare it to is we have this sudden influx of refugees, you know, overnight with this sort of crash of the American-supported government in Afghanistan. It sort of reminds me of like the Mariel boat lift from Cuba in, I believe, 1983, if I recall the exact year. Again, back in the 1980s, you know, something in my early
1980.
It was 1980. Okay, right. Yeah, I mean, there, you know, Castro sort of like opened up his country and said, okay, anyone who wants to get out, you can get out. But, of course, he like, you know, let out like a lot of prisoners and so forth. I mean, that seems to be an analogy there. I mean, what happened with that boat lift?
Well, the reason that happened, it's actually the analogy there is to what we're seeing at the border now, because just as Biden essentially invited this immigration wave, Jimmy Carter had said there was a kind of brewing small crisis where a bunch of people, this is in 1980, a bunch of Cubans had stormed the Peruvian embassy, and they were all on the grounds of the Peruvian embassy, and it was sort of a, it was becoming kind of a diplomatic hot potato. And so what Jimmy Carter said is, we welcome them with open hearts and open arms. That's the way he said it. And Fidel Castro, as you suggested, said, oh, okay. And he let them out and emptied his prisons, also salted some spies and others. And we ended up with well over 100,000 people showing up in South Florida in a matter of weeks. It was a complete disaster politically for Jimmy Carter. The interesting difference between what we're seeing today with Biden's invitation creating this illegal immigration wave and back with Jimmy Carter in 1980 is that Carter had not run as Mr. Open Borders. The Democratic Party was very different. It was still more liberal than the Republicans. I mean, maybe. I don't even know if you can typify it that way, because the Republicans were often pretty bad too. But it wasn't. There were all kinds of pro-immigration control forces within the Democratic Party, not least of which was AFL-CIO, which defected since then in the early 2000, mid-2000s and joined the Open Borders side. But back then, Jimmy Carter had not run as Mr. Open Borders, so he was able to shut that off. He was able to do a complete 180 and stop it. Joe Biden is created the same kind of migration emergency as Jimmy Carter did, much worse, of course. But he ran as the anti-Trump, and anything Trump did, he had to not do. And so he's kind of boxed himself into a corner, and how does he get out of it? They are trying to do some things to enforce the border, belatedly, because they looked at the poll numbers and they realize they're going to be annihilated in November. And they are actually doing some things, like flying some Central Americans back to Central America rather than letting them in. They're still letting a lot in, but some of them they're flying back. They're hoping that's going to make enough difference. I don't think it is. But the whole – what it really shows is how limited his options are politically, precisely because he ran as the anti-border enforcement candidate. And his base is, you know, fanatically anti-borders. And even the relatively small steps the administration has been taking belatedly to try to walk back some of Biden's invitation to illegal immigrants. For instance, the gaps in the fence that happened because Biden told the construction people literally the minute after he was inaugurated to put down their tools, stop all construction, doesn't matter what state things are in. There are literally holes and gaps in the fence. I've gone to see him. He, a year later, said, yeah, maybe we'll at least just fix those little gaps in the fence. Even that is too tough, too pro-borders for a lot of the people in this administration who came in with Biden, and some of them have quit because of these things. So this is the long way of saying Jimmy Carter had the political flexibility to shut off the illegal immigration wave that he created. Biden doesn't have that kind of flexibility, and so it's going to continue to be bad as long as he's in office. I mean, it may get, you know, it'll fluctuate. Some months it'll go down, other months it'll go up, but he can't fix this. He can't restore stability to the border as literally as long as he's in the White House.
Interesting. Well, looking at this current influx, I mean, I guess there's sort of similar numbers here. You talk about like 100,000 in 1980 under Jimmy Carter from Cuba, and now we're looking at, as your statistics have indicated, something like 123,000 people flown out back last summer from Afghanistan. Have these refugees have undergone any vetting to speak of? Have any problems arisen from them? I mean, you talk about like this issue of sexual assault, and there have been other issues of like Fort McCoy in Wisconsin with sexual assaults on women's service members. So, I mean, what sort of scrutiny has been applied to these people coming in?
Yeah, we're assured that they're vetted and it's all great and nothing to worry about, and you're a racist if you're concerned about it. But, you know, those are the same people who told us 15 days to flatten the curve. You know what I mean? So the fact is the just recently, this was last week, I think, the Department of Defense Inspector General, which is kind of like the watchdog, sort of independent watchdog. Each agency has somebody like this to, and what they do is they look at things like how the money is spent, but the Department of Defense Inspector General just released a report specifically on vetting of Afghans. And one of my people is writing up. He read through the whole thing. It's pretty complicated. But what the upshot is that they did, in fact, you know, run everybody's name through some kind of background check, some kind of database check. But there's two issues there. The broader issue is that you know, garbage in, garbage out. I mean, if you don't have any information about who this person is in the database, then nothing's going to come up when you search for them. Doesn't mean that they're okay. I mean, and, you know, what can you do anyway? We can call up the DMV and cobble, you know, from countries that are either hostile or are where the state has failed. There's, you know, vetting doesn't mean anything. It's kabuki theater. It's, you know, we run their names through, and unless there's some kind of internationally known drug smuggler or money launderer, nothing's going to come up. The other problem specifically that the Defense Department's Inspector General found is that different groups of Afghans were vetted by different agencies, so that Homeland Security vetted some of them, Department of Defense vetted others. The Homeland Security people didn't have access to the same databases. Like, for instance, if their fingerprints were found on the remains of a roadside bomb, the Department of Defense is very aggressive about attaining, you know, compiling that kind of information. Well, Homeland Security was using a different database. And you know, all kinds of people were released into the United States before they figured out what the problem was. And it was at least 50 people that got in despite derogatory information, as the intelligence people put it. And what the inspector general did is looked, they picked out 31, and they said, okay, now where are these people? 28 of them they couldn't find. We have no idea where they are. So these are people that had some kind of issue. Now, you know, maybe, who knows whether they were real, actual kind of terrorist actors or whether they just had some kind of terrorist connection. But the majority of them that had some kind of red flag are in the wind. We don't know where they are. So, you know, when somebody tells you, rest easy, they're all being vetted, trust us, don't trust them.
What about, you know, this whole issue, you know, sort of similar to vetting, there's this issue of, you know, we're bringing in people from Afghanistan on these special immigrant visa programs that, you know, these are people who really, you know, stood with the United States, worked with the United States, fought with the United States in Afghanistan, and, you know, we got to bring them in, they're really at danger. And then, you know, that also then plays into this idea of vetting. Is that really true? What is this special immigrant visa program, you know, what are the pitfalls of that?
There's two kinds of special immigrant visas for people who were allied with us in Afghanistan. One small one is for people who were actually translators, interpreters with our guys in uniform. So these are people who went out, they had, you know, the bulletproof vests, they were outside the wire with our guys, taking real risks, helping servicemen. That's a small program, and there's just not that many people like that. There are some, I mean, you know, there's thousands, but the number isn't huge. Other special immigrant visa, it's for kind of everybody else, including people who worked for a construction company that did construction for us, people who worked in the commissary doling out food, you know, at lunchtime. That's a much larger program, and that's the bulk. I mean, it's a legal thing. Congress passed it. It's not like the laws are being broken. It's that do we really have an obligation to somebody who worked for a food service contractor in an army base in Afghanistan? I mean, we probably do have some obligation, certainly to get them out if they're in danger. But getting people out of Afghanistan who may have helped us is not the same as letting them in to the U.S. There's a whole 192 other countries in the world, and it seems to me that the bar for our saying we need to get you out is lower. The bar that you would have to clear to say that we should let you move here as opposed to help you get set up somewhere else in Pakistan or what have you, that's a lot higher. And unfortunately, for the way the special immigrant visa works, is there's no distinction that most of the people saying, you know, most of the people that are being described as, you know, our allies who have to be let in are in that second category. They work for a construction company. They were the, you know, private security guard somewhere, worked in cafeteria, what have you, you know, filed papers in an office. And, you know, that's not nothing, but that really, you know, should that really result in getting a visa to live you and your entire family for the rest of your lives in the United States? I don't think so.
Hmm. Interesting. And you talk about, we've discussed this idea of resettlement abroad. What possibilities would exist then for Afghanistan? I mean, Pakistan or Iran, would they be able to take in more refugees? I mean, Pakistan, of course, during the 1980s had a history of, you know, lots of Afghans fled there during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan and the fighting going on there. Could they take in more, or Iran perhaps, or any other country?
Yeah, I mean, Iran and Pakistan do take a lot of them, and even now, I mean, they have a lot of them. I mean, it's not like Iran's going to be working with us or anybody else in resettling people, but, you know, Central Asia is a big place. There's a whole bunch of stands there. Tajikistan, they speak the same language as in Afghanistan. In fact, a lot of the refugees are themselves ethnic Tajiks, and Tajik, the language, is basically a version of Persian, which is what almost everybody in Afghanistan also speaks. But, you know, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, now you say, well, you know, they're ethnically different and we don't like them. It's like, well, too bad. What does that mean? This isn't Afghanistan either. So it seems to me that there's all kinds of places in the region that we'd be happy to help fund the resettlement because it's so much cheaper than bringing people here. And the other benefit is that if things do change in Afghanistan, they're nearby. They're actually able to return because the success of a refugee operation, the real success is that people are able to go back when the emergency that they fled is over. And, you know, I mean, who knows what will happen in Afghanistan, but nothing lasts forever. And if people are nearby, they're just a whole lot more likely to be able to go home. And, you know, this idea that the only option for refugee resettlement is for them to move to Kenosha, Wisconsin or something is something that the State Department really does seem to operate under. And there's one example that really jumped out at me when I'd read about it. We've written some on it. These are people from Somalia. They're called Somali Bantus. And they're a subgroup within Somalia. They're the descendants of slaves, that Arab slavers who governed the whole east coast of Africa until relatively recently. Arab slavers captured or bought these people from what is now Tanzania and Mozambique, and they ended up in Somalia. And their descendants, they're called Somali Bantus. They're considered subhumans by the Somalis. They hate them, racially hate them. And a lot of them ended up in refugee camps. And so what Mozambique and Tanzania were willing to take these people, their long-lost cousins, and resettle them in their countries. They said, you know, U.S., U.N., somebody needs to help us out with this because you got to dig wells and all that stuff. But, you know, we're happy to take our, you know, our long-lost, the descendants of our, you know, our cousins back. The United States said, no, heck with that. We'll just move them to the United States instead. It's absurd. There's no excuse for that. It was just seen as kind of a political hot potato, so why not just throw that problem over your shoulder into the United States if you're the State Department? That's kind of the way they think of it. There was another group like that, Nepalis who live in Bhutan. This is in the Himalayas. And when you look at the statistics, the refugees, we get a significant number from Bhutan, except they're not Bhutanese. They're Nepali, which is the next-door country. And it's a long story about how they got there, but the Bhutanese don't want them there anymore. Different language, all of that stuff. Nepal isn't willing to take them back, and India's like, hey, well, if somebody else will take them, that's fine with us. So the State Department says, no, we'll just move them to the United States instead. It's ridiculous. You know, we use refugee resettlement as a kind of tool of foreign policy, as a way to resolve problems overseas without any concern about what problems it may create within the United States itself.
looking at the United States itself, discuss more the actual then resettlement process here in the United States. How do refugees get resettled, and why, for example, you know, you talk about these concentrations of Afghans in you know, Washington, D.C. area, San Francisco area, Sacramento area, which, as your analysts have noted, you know, these are actually, you know, areas with high cost of living, and yet they have these concentrations of Afghan refugees, you know, who are struggling to adjust to this modern society. How does something like that happen?
Well, the way refugee, specifically the refugee process, this is not asylum of people showing up at the border, but refugees, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, has like a list of people. They keep a list of people who they think warrant resettlement. In whether it's here or Europe or whatever, they warrant resettlement. For under Trump, where we kind of tried to run things on our own, every other administration just basically looks at the UNHCR list and takes people off that list. And they're, you know, interviewed by the State Department, what have you, or often interviewed by local people paid by the State Department. And often you'll end up with some real corruption issues there. Then they're flown to the United States, and a local what used to be called a voluntary organization, I think they have some other name for them, but basically it's a private contractor, most of them religious affiliated, like Catholic Charities or Lutheran Immigrant Refugee Services. They're paid by the State Department to handle the resettlement. And so you think the way they present this is, oh, well, you know, they're sponsoring these people, and that's great, and there's no cost to the taxpayer, because that's the way it worked after World War II. But that's not the way it works now. Under that 1980 Refugee Act that I mentioned, set up this gravy train that a bureaucracy has developed to live off of, where these religious groups and their subcontractors are paid by the head to find a place to, for these people to live, and they do support them for the first few months, but the main job is to drive them to the welfare office and sign them up. After a few months, the supposed, you know, charity group is off the hook. The taxpayer is now paying the bill, and they go get another batch of refugees so they can get more money off of it. It's a complete racket. It's unbelievably irresponsible, and it drives much higher numbers than if sponsors were actually responsible for all of the costs of these folks, which is the way it worked, you know, after World War II in the 40s and 50s, even 60s, until the Refugee Act changed the way that whole thing operated.
So in the past, saying, you know, sponsors were responsible, did that mean, like, did they have to, like, commit to supporting them for, like, I don't know, like a decade or something, and saying, you know, if they ever need any welfare or something, you'll have to pay for it. They can't get any public assistance.
Yeah, that's the way it worked. That's supposedly the way it works now, even for regular immigration. For most immigrants, they have to have sponsors that sign an affidavit of support, they call it, except that it's basically meaningless because it's not enforced. Just as a quick story, when Mayor Bloomberg, Michael Bloomberg was mayor of New York before the before what's-his-name, de Blasio, at the end of his administration, he said, wait a minute, you know, these people on welfare, they have affidavits of support. Let's go and bill the sponsors because, you know, it's costing New York City taxpayers money. So they billed the sponsors. They found out. They did the research. They billed sponsors. And a lot of sponsors, like, oh, my God, you know, I'm on the hook for this. They paid, or, you know, at least partly, they wrote checks to the city. But it was right at the end of his administration, and guess, you know, Bill de Blasio, the Marxist, took over. They sent all the money back. So even the sponsorship requirements that do exist still in the law on paper are utterly meaningless because no one's willing to actually enforce them.
So that would mean that, you know, a sponsor has a duty to sponsor until what, the person gets citizenship or until the person gets a green card or
Yeah, until they become citizens, because when they're citizens, then they're just, you know, Americans like anybody else.
Oh, interesting, huh? Okay, well, yeah, so that's well, and so are these refugee resettlement organizations then, are they taking people to, like, San Francisco or Washington, D.C. precisely because there's really high, you know, levels of social services there, welfare and so forth? I mean, these are relatively liberal cities and so forth.
No, no, actually, that's the interesting thing, is that the refugee resettlement groups try to place people in low-cost areas. And in fact, they often coordinate with cheap labor employers like meat packers to procure cheap labor for them if they're out in the remote area in the Midwest. Literally, some of these groups, ostensible religious charity groups, are recruiting arms for these exploitative meat packing companies. The reason you see Afghans, for instance, clustering in expensive places like Sacramento and Northern Virginia is that's where the earlier waves, the post-Soviet invasion waves of more educated and prosperous Afghans settled and created a community, and people want to move to where their fellow countrymen are. I mean, if you're a newcomer, you know what I mean? It's disorienting. You want to go someplace where at least there's something familiar. That's just a normal human thing. And so even if it costs a lot more, if they resettle, an Afghan refugee family in, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a low-cost place, you know, Amarillo, Texas or something. I'm just making that up. I have no idea. But let's say they
Nebraska
do that.
Maybe, or something, yeah.
Whatever, yeah. But they have a brother-in-law who lives in Sacramento. You know, once they're resettled, they don't have to stay there. No, there's nobody's, you know, there's no policeman guarding them. They can just get on the bus and go to Sacramento. You know what I mean? So that's what happens. That's what we saw with the Vietnamese in the 70s and 80s. We tried to resettle them an inch thick across the country, you know, to spread them out. They all ended up concentrating in various places because, you know, they went to where their friends and relatives were, and they sort of, you know, created these ethnic communities. The natural thing, that's just the way people are.
So in the case of like the Somalis or the Hmong or now the Afghans, would they themselves then go to places with like high levels of social services, Minneapolis or Washington, D.C. or San Francisco? So they themselves are doing that.
Yeah. Often when these communities, if there aren't already communities here, they may get started. For instance, in Minnesota, because there was active these charity groups doing the resettling. Like, I'm pretty sure in Minnesota would have been Lutheran Immigrant Refugee Services. Once you start a little immigrant community, you settle a few families in some place where there's no, you know, no folks like that. Well, now you've started a little, it's like putting a grain of sand in an oyster. You know what I mean? Stuff grows off of that. So people will sometimes move because there's good social services, but sometimes because that's just where the sponsor happened to be. And it just kind of gets a momentum of its own once you start that flow.
All right. Excellent. Well, for our listeners out there, we've been listening here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show discussing important current events for conservatives and others with your show host, Andrew Harrod. And we've been talking about America's Afghan refugees in the wake of the collapse of the American-supported government in Kabul, Afghanistan last summer with the Center for Immigration Studies Executive Director, Mark Krikorian. Well, Mark, thank you for joining the show.
Thank you, Andrew.
All right, well, tune in next week for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.
We clear?